Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's February 22nd. Last time you had a test, your first test in here, and I got your grades into Blackboard, I think Saturday, so you can check those, unless you didn't show me a Cypress College picture ID or a Fullerton College picture ID. Then you'll have to see me during office hours, and I can clear your grade, right? So don't forget, you need that ID to take the exams in here. So we're in the axial skeleton, and starting next week, on Wednesday, practicum 2 begins. All right, the Monday group doesn't take the second practicum for 2 weeks yet. All right, so just to get you aware of what's going on, and then when we get that second practicum out of the way, we'll have our second test as well. I noticed that some people have not been doing their online quizzes, the weekly online quizzes, and that's kind of a shame, because guess how many you get to miss before you're dropped from the class? Yeah, only three, right? So don't pretend that nobody's going to notice if you don't do those quizzes. And it's just a way to keep you current in the class. They're really easy to do. As long as you read the chapter and then do the online quizzes, you get feedback from the online quizzes, and then which are practice quizzes, and then you can take the actual quiz. All right, so that helps you a lot for the tests as well. All right, so does anybody have any questions? You're also very welcome to see me during office hours to review your test. And I'll go over the test with my students in lab. I think it's a really good learning experience. So, and if you didn't do really well, maybe you're making a really silly systematic mistake with taking the test. Maybe you're not filling out the A bubble when you meant to put the A, or you got stray marks. Oh, yeah. What did I mention about stray marks? Don't put any stray marks on the Scantron. And there's a ton of students that make notes to themselves on the Scantron, okay? That's really bad. That's shooting yourself in the foot, is what they say, okay? Don't make any extraneous marks on your Scantron. So if you come and correct your test with me, you know, we can catch those things and give you credit for those scores. All right, so we were in axial skeleton, and it's been so long ago since I've been talking to you all, I can't exactly remember where we left off, but I think we started talking about all these different landmarks on bones, right? So you know what a process is? What's a process? Who could maybe describe what the heck is a process? It's a bump on a bone, right? So it's an elevation on a bone. Now, is it going to be smooth or is it going to be rough if you palpate it with your fingertips? It's going to be rough because it's used for muscle attachments. Something attaches to the bone in that location that's pulling and tugging on it. And just like if you were to exercise a muscle, what would happen to your muscle if you were to exercise a muscle? Like if you walked around all day and you curled a 5-pound weight with your right arm, what would your right arm look compared to your left arm? Yeah, it'd get bit. As a matter of fact, probably most people's right arms are bigger than their left arms anyway, because most people use their right arm a lot more than their left. All right, same thing for a bone. If you exercise a bone, it's going to get bigger and stronger as well, especially at that location where a muscle is pulling on it. All right, so don't forget, a bone is still living tissue. And I think I did mention this. Your whole skeleton is replaced every 5 years and rebuilt in the way that you use your body. All right, so a process, and you can see a number of different names for processes: trochanter, malleolus, crest, spine, line. These are all used for muscle attachments, so they're rough raised areas on a bone. A depression. What's the function of a depression on a bone? A depression is, a dip, but what's the function? What's the use for that? It's for holding something. Yeah, it's for holding something. We're going to look at some cranial fossas for holding different parts of our brains. And so a fossa sometimes is used to designate a depression or a sulcus, a groove, or an alveolus. Those of you that have had lab already, what kind of special depression is an alveolus? It's for holding what? Yeah, your teeth. Your tooth is like a peg, and it fits in a socket, a depression in the mandible, and we call that an alveolus. All right, what's the function of a hole in a bone? It's a passageway for something. Could be a nerve, could be artery or blood vessel, or probably all three of those things. And the most common name for a passageway in a bone is called a foramen, right? Anybody know what the plural for foramen is? Foramina. Foramina is plural for foramen, okay? But meatus, canal, fissure, sinus, these are all passageways in bones. And now a sinus could mean a number of different things. There are numerous words in science that you have to understand what its particular meaning is by the context that it's used in, like the nucleus. When we say nucleus, what can that mean? What in science? Anybody have a couple understandings of what nucleus means? Nucleus could be the nucleus inside of a cell that contains DNA, but nucleus could also be the center part of an atom that has protons and neutrons in it. In anatomy, nucleus could also mean a very special part of somebody's brain, which we're going to look at when we get to the nervous system. All right, sinus is another one of those terms in anatomy. A sinus sometimes contains blood, sometimes a sinus can contain fluid, sometimes a sinus can contain just air, maybe lymphatic tissue. All right, and the sinuses in bones basically contain air. All right, like when we talk about the paranasal sinuses. And then we have raised, smooth areas on a bone. This is not for muscle attachment, but this is used for forming joints, right? So that when two bones move with respect to each other, they don't grind each other away. They're nice and smooth and slip. Oh, you guys, tell me that it's not showing. The blue screen of death. Okay. All right. So, now that's much better. Okay, and then lastly there is a term called a ramus. And a ramus is just some part of a bone that is projecting off of the main body of a bone at 90 degrees. All right, and there's a really good example of that in a facial bone, namely the mandible. The body of the mandible is straight, horizontal, in a transverse plane. It runs anterior, posteriorly, but when it gets back to the angle, it starts to course superiorly, which is at a 90 degrees. All right, and so we call that the ramus of the mandible. Okay, so, well, let's start looking at some pictures. All right, so don't forget that the skeleton should be thought up of or broken down into two main groups of bones. And the two main groups are either the axial skeleton as opposed to the appendicular skeleton. Appendicular skeleton is made up of the upper appendage and lower appendage, right? And axial skeleton is made up of the skull, the vertebral column, and the thoracic cage. And the thoracic cage is made up of ribs as well as the sternum. All right, so the axial skeleton is not necessarily used for movement, but mostly for protecting underlying structures. Like, give me a good example of what the axial skeleton is protecting. Yeah. Yeah, for instance, in the thoracic cage right here, it's protecting your heart. You don't want any holes in your heart. Okay, what else? The brain and spinal cord. Yeah, those are some really good things, right? So the cranial bones protect the brain, and the vertebral column right here protect the spinal cord, which are very delicate nervous tissues. All right, but the appendicular skeleton is mostly made or is there for motion, for motility, right? Okay. So let's look at some structures of the skull. And I don't know if we got this far last time or not, but here's a really good exam figure. And whenever you see a figure, you see a lot of lead lines that are annotated right here. And for sure, you have to know for the lecture test the names of all of these lead lines right here if they're given to you in the lab manual. All right, so you might run into some figures that have extra little structures that are not listed in your lab manual, and we're not going to hold you accountable for those. So use your lab manual as the key. All right, so what's a really good way? I think You know, in the study guides, I've given you all of these figures with the lead lines erased, so you can practice labeling these, and hopefully everybody gets 100% on that part of the test, right? Just like last time. Okay, so the bones that make up the skull can as well be broken down into two main groups, maybe three or four depending, but mostly two main groups. Bones that protect the brain, which we see up over here, these are what we call cranial bones. And then there are other bones that are important for breathing, for eating, for articulation or communication, and we call and facial expression. And so those we call facial bones. So try to group bones into those two main categories. The other two minor categories, that there are some very, very tiny bones inside the temporal bone over here that we call auditory ossicles. These are important for hearing. They're tiny, tiny, tiny. There's three of them. And if I were to hold them between my fingertips just like this, and even though you're sitting really close, you still couldn't see them anyway because they're so small. All right, so they're inside the temporal bone. And then another bone that is placed inside the mandible, which we can't see over here, is called the hyoid bone. And so if I had to group the hyoid bone, I wouldn't even consider it a skull bone, but it's kind of closely associated with the skull bone. And the auditory ossicles don't fit into facial or cranial bones either. All right, so here we see some holes. Oh, and this is the mental area of the mandible, so this is called the mental foramen. Guess what that function of the mental foramen is? Yeah, passageway for nerves, for instance, and blood vessels. All right, so the lower jawbone is the mandible, the upper jawbone is the maxilla, your cheekbones are the zygomatic right here. All right, most of your nose that we look at all the time is made out of cartilage, and so that is not shown on this particular illustration. We only see the bony structures of the skull. All right, so the first bones of the nose form the bridge of the nose, and of course we call those the nasal bones. Those are pretty small. And then there's two other bones that make up the nasal septum, and a septum is just a wall that separates the nasal cavity into two areas. All right, and the upper part is made up of the ethmoid, and the lower part is made up of the vomer. All right, so we got ethmoid and vomer, and probably you can see that these are nicely color-coded on this diagram right here, but that helps you in learning. But don't forget, on the exam, what color are the exam figures? Yeah, they're just grayscale. So you got to just don't know names of bones by color, because that won't help you out. All right, since we're talking about the nasal cavity right here, there are some other bones that you can see inside the nasal cavity. And these are shelves that we call turbinates. And there are three main shelves. So here's the inferior nasal conche. That's a bone all by itself. And then the middle and superior, which we can't see over here, are part of the bone that makes this superior part of the nasal septum. So they're actually part of the ethmoid bone. All right, and so the job, guess what the job of these nasal conchae are? What do they do? Why are they in there? Why are they in there? Yeah, when you breathe, right, air is a fluid, and it can become turbulent. And when it becomes turbulent, it resists flow. And you need nice, smooth flow so that you can get that air into your lungs. So these turbinates order the air so it flows very nice and smoothly into your lungs. That's one thing that it does. Same thing for the nasal septum right here. So as a matter of fact, if somebody has a broken nose or a deviated nasal septum or these nasal conchae that are broken, guess what kind of difficulty they have with breathing? A little bit or none at all or a lot? Actually a lot. Okay, they actually might have to go in and remove some of these or straighten them out, reduce them or whatever. Okay. The other thing is that they're covered with a mucous membrane, which is moist. So as you're breathing in dry air, guess what those moist membranes do? They humidify the air so your lungs don't turn into potato chips. That's a really good thing. And if the air is hot, it cools the air down so that you don't burn your lungs. So basically all of these structures right here is an air conditioning system for your respiratory passageways and your lungs. Okay. So the lower floor of the nasal passageway is made up of the maxilla, and then there's one bone that's posterior. Maybe if I can zoom ahead right here, there's one bone that's posterior So here's the maxilla. Forms the floor of the nasal cavity, and there's one posterior to it, and that's the palatine bone. All right, the palatine bone, or at least this part of the palatine bone, and this horizontal plate of the maxilla, which sometimes we call the palatine process, makes the bony part of the roof of the mouth, which we call the hard palate. So this is important not only for breathing, but of course for speaking, and probably even more importantly would be eating, right? Taking in nourishment. All right, I want to say one last thing about these palatine bones right here. Let me go back to this figure right here. The palatine bones, if you're going to think of a letter of the alphabet, can anybody tell me what the palatine bone looks like? And you probably would have had to have seen this in lab. If you haven't had this in lab yet, you won't be able to answer that question. Okay, somebody maybe said, but I didn't hear. So I'm going to tell you. It looks like an L. All right, so you have two palatine bones that kind of look like this, and they fit together. So you see my thumb and my index finger coming together, and look what it forms.
Triangle.
Yeah, nice nasal cavity. You're right, it forms a triangle just kind of like that, right? Which kind of looks like what? A gigantic nasal cavity, right? Because my hand's a lot bigger than my nose. All right, and what about the floor of the nasal cavity? It's made up of what part of my hand? My thumb, right? And the walls of the nasal cavity are made up of the perpendicular plates of the palatine bone that fit just like that, right behind your maxilla. All right, so I want you to have kind of a picture of what the palatine bone looks like. So those are all the bones that make up the nasal cavity. All right, so those are pretty much all facial bones with the exception of the ethmoid. The ethmoid, way back over here behind the frontal bone, makes up part of the floor of the cranial fossa. And I'll show you where that is in just a little bit. All right, well, what are some other bones, some other structures? Well, we see the orbits here and here, which are your eye sockets. And there are some bones that make up the orbits. And you can see part of the zygomatic bone makes up the orbit, the maxilla, the frontal bone, here as well. And then there's a bone that goes all the way across from the right to the left side of the head, all right, making up the posterior part of the orbit, and that's the sphenoid bone. The sphenoid bone, even though you think it might be a facial bone, it's not. It's a cranial bone because you can't see that bone if you look at somebody's face because it's what? Way posterior to the eye. Okay. So those are some bones besides. Let me see what else. So I'm answering some questions for you that were homework questions. All right, so you got the ethmoid bone, also makes the orbit, and the lacrimal bone right here. All right, there's a depression in the lacrimal bone that we call the lacrimal fossa, and there is even a foramen that goes from the orbit into the nasal cavity. And what can you tell me about your nose when your eyes are teary? Yeah, it drains into your nasal cavity. You might even have stuff running out of your nose when you're crying, right? Those tears go right out your nose, not just out of your eyes, because they go through this lacrimal bone right into the nasal cavity. There's a nasal lacrimal duct right there. All right, so those are pretty much all the bones that are facial bones. So let's review them really quick. Mandible, maxilla is the upper jawbone. The cheekbone is the zygomatic. Bridge the nose, the bone on the bridge of the nose is the nasal bone. And then we got, again, the maxilla right here. Just posterior to the maxilla is the lacrimal bone. And that's a very, very, very thin bone. If we had a real bone in lab, if you were to touch it, just the acids in your fingers would just dissolve that bone away. So we do have some real skeletons, some real skulls, in a few places in lab, and you'll notice that there's just going to be a hole where the lacrimal bone is because people touch it and it just dissolves away. And then posterior to the lacrimal bone right here is the ethmoid. Oh, guess what we're going over right now for my lab at noon? Guess what we're doing right now? We're going over the quiz, right? Okay, don't forget your quiz. All right, so those are the facial bones. All right, now bones that make up the cranial vault. All right, the cranial bones, the major large bones, all right, the frontal bone right here, and that also makes up the orbit. And also, I do want to say that when you study bones, spend a lot of time with bones and become very familiar with them. Don't just memorize them to get through a quiz or a test, because guess what? You're going to want that information on your fingertips when you go through the rest of the class for the following reason. We're going to study a lot of neuroanatomy in here, and there is a part of the brain that's associated with a frontal bone right here, right? It's a lobe of the cerebrum. Guess what the name of that lobe is? That's the frontal lobe, right? So if you know your bone anatomy, which is pretty easy, because maybe we probably all bonked this bone pretty hard in our life and know that it's there, right? So that's a frontal bone. And then we get posterior to that is a parietal lobe. Guess what the lobe of the brain is? That's the parietal lobe, right? And then we got the occipital bone. That's the most posterior bone in the skull. And guess what the name of the lobe of the brain is right there? That's the occipital lobe. So you're learning like four or five different chapters of information if you really pay attention to these bones. Okay. All right. There's only one joint in the skull that articulates, which means that allows for motion. There are a number of joints between, for instance, between the frontal bone and the parietal bone, and we see it right here, but that is an immovable fibrous joint. It's not supposed to move. It moves a little bit, but not very much, unless you're watching a science fiction movie and watching somebody from Mars, right, and their head kind of moves back and forth as they're talking. But in humans, that doesn't move. The only joint that moves is the temporomandibular joint, right? So here's the temporal bone, here's the mandible. So this is the only joint right here, called a TMJ for short, right? Instead of temporomandibular joint, that's a little long-winded. All the other bones, all the other joints are fibrous joints and movable. So between the frontal and parietal, that we call that the coronal suture. A suture is a joint. Right? Here, we have kind of a flat part of your skull. Right? If you look in the mirror, that's kind of flat right there. What's the name for flat that we like to use in anatomy? Squamous. So here is the squamous region of the temporal bone, and here is the squamosal suture, or squamous suture, because it's in the flat part of our skull. A suture between the parietal and occipital bones, that's a lambdoid or lambdoidal suture, right? And then between the temporal bone and occipital bone, that's the occipitomastoid suture. Because this right here is a mastoid process kind of right behind your earlobe. It's a big, massive bony prominence right there. And it's rough. So guess what the function of this mastoid process is? Muscle attachment. Big, strong muscles that hold your head up, that allow you to move your head around, okay? Helping going through the yes motion, no motion, maintaining posture of your neck so that you don't break your neck. So that's a big, strong muscle attachment. Here's another muscle attachment, not nearly as strong. That's the styloid process. Muscles for articulation and breathing and eating are going to be attached to this one. And then we have a hole in the temporal bone. Guess what that lines up with? Yeah, your ear. So that's the external auditory meatus. Sometimes we call it a canal. This is a hole in the temporal bone that allows sound pressure to enter the temporal bone so that you can hear things. And in this part of the temporal bone, that's where those auditory ossicles are, very deep inside the temporal bone. Now, this hole doesn't go all the way into your brain. You don't want to have a hole going in all the way from the outside world into your brain. It just enters the temporal bone and allow sound to stimulate some organs that are in the center, in the middle of the temporal bone. So when we get to senses, we'll see where that is. All right, let's talk about some nomenclature. I see a number of processes. Here is a temporal bone, and it forms, it reaches out and touches the zygomatic bone right here, and in so doing, it forms an arch, which we call the zygomatic arch. Zygomatic arch is made partly out of the zygomatic bone and partly out of the temporal bone. So how do we name this process right here? It's at, what bone is this process on? It's on the temporal bone, but we don't want to call it the temporal process. What do we want to call it? You're going to have to look at this, and once you see how we name things, it will be really easy. So if we have a process on a bone, we don't name it after the bone that it's on. We name it after the bone that it is touching or forming a suture with. All right? So this right here, process is touching the zygomatic bone. So this is what we call the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Here's a process on the zygomatic bone right here, right? But we're not going to call that the zygomatic process. We name it after the bone that it's touching. What bone is it touching? The temporal bone. So this is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone, okay? And here's the zygomatic again. It's reaching up and touching the frontal bone. So here is the process on the zygomatic that's touching the frontal bone. So what would you name this process right here? That would be the frontal process of the zygomatic bone, okay? All right. Now, what bone do I have the cursor on right now? That's the maxilla. And look, here is a process that's reaching up and touching the frontal bone. So tell me what the process of this, where I have the cursor right now. That's the frontal process of the maxilla. All right, so once you see that nomenclature, it becomes really easy to name these different processes. Okay, if you don't see that, maybe you see me during office hours or something. All right, so here's a good exam figure. This probably you should look over. It's not an exam figure, but it shows you some bones that make up the nasal septum, namely part of the ethmoid and then part of the vomer right here, the bones that make up the hard palate. And clinically, this is really important because some people are born with a cleft palate. There's a malformation in the hard palate. So there is there's a patent passageway between the oral cavity and the nasal cavity. All right, and it's just amazing that anybody can even live a couple months with a cleft palate, because in the first month of your life, what do you have to do?
Breathe.
Well, you have to breathe, and of course you have to breathe every minute, right? But you also have to eat, right? And you can't suckle, you can't nurse unless you can form, right, around a nipple or something and suck. So how do these people even get nourishment into their bodies? I guess their mothers just have to like dribble food into their mouth, okay? So that surgery is done probably as quickly as possible so that infants can get adequate nutrition, right? Because if you have food in your mouth, it's going to go up in your nose and then out your nose, but it's not going to go down into your stomach, all right? Okay, so these are the two important bones. So what are these two important bones again that make the hard palate? The palatine, which is posterior, and the maxilla, okay, which is anterior, right? And so why do we call this the palatine process? Because it's touching the palatine bone right there, right? So that's the palatine process. Okay. There was a bone that we said that makes up the inferior part of the orbit, and it goes all the way from the right side of the head all the way over to the other. It's a cranial bone, and here we see it right here. That's the sphenoid bone. Kind of looks like, if we look at it in isolation, it looks like a bat or a butterfly or something. And you can see it has some big cavities inside of it right here, and these are what we call the sphenoid sinuses. And all the sinuses that we're going to be interested in, including the frontal sinus right here, which is in what bone? The frontal bone. It's filled with lymphatic tissue, and that lymphatic tissue fights infection, fights bacteria and viruses that are trying to get inside your body through what? Your nasal cavity and oral cavity right here. So that helps protect your body from infection. And then I see this depression. And this is a very special depression, so we don't even call it a fossa. We call it the cella turcica. It's in the sphenoid bone. But it is basically a fossa, which, what's the function of a fossa again? It holds something. Did anybody read ahead in the chapter to find out what sits right in this little depression right here? Really critical little gland, which we call the pituitary gland, okay? And that helps control many other endocrine functions in your body. And so it's sitting right at the base of the brain. Okay, sometimes a tumor forms in this pituitary gland. It has to be removed. All right, and it's right at the base of the brain. Do you think that's a really difficult procedure to get at that pituitary? And I just want to change your mind a little bit about that, because a surgeon can go right in the oral cavity, go right through this very thin part of the sphenoid bone, another really thin part of the sphenoid bone, right in the roof of the mouth, and you're right there at the pituitary gland. So it's actually a relatively easy procedure. Easy for me to say. Okay, I wouldn't want anybody digging around in the base of my brain, but this is relatively easy because you can go right through the roof of the mouth. So when you study anatomy, you get to appreciate different surgical approaches and how something that might seem really, really difficult is actually quite easy to do if you know your anatomy. So try to study all of these different pictures. Okay, so again, we see frontal bone, parietal, occipital, and here is the temporal bone. We also see an interior aspect of the mandible, and here is another foramen in the mandible, and we call that the mandibular foramen. What did we call the one that was anterior?
Mental.
The mental foramen, right? And there are important nerves that go through this mandibular foramen that innervate these nerves right here. So that's typically the nerve that's anesthetized whenever you have dental work done. Okay, and I'm sure probably everybody in here has had their mouth anesthetized, right, by injecting Novocaine right into this nerve right here. Oh, something else that's kind of important. Typically, these teeth that we have way back over here in our mouth, what do we call those things? Yeah, they're molars. Okay, and sometimes you have a third molar, right? I see two right here. Sometimes you have a third molar. What do we call a third molar? They're highly problematic in most people. Yeah, wisdom teeth. Usually there's not enough room for them to grow in the angle of the mandible right here, and they can become impacted. And so they're extracted. Okay, but here's that nerve. And sometimes that nerve is damaged when they're extracted, and then you lose feeling in that part of your jaw as well. Okay, so it's just another example of why knowing some basic anatomy like this that might seem intimidating to you should be really interested in, because you might have to deal with this stuff in your daily life. Okay. All right, so that's pretty good with that figure. So this is nice because you can see the nasal septum and some other aspects of the cranium. Okay, I don't really go over this picture very much, except you can see the zygomatic arch very nicely right here, made up of the zygomatic process of the temporal bone, the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. You can see the horizontal plate of the maxilla, right, and the horizontal plate of the palatine bone right here. And so I think those are pretty important to look at. Okay, now this is a really good figure. And if you were to look at this in three dimensions like you can in lab, you're going to notice three major depressions. All right, so we're looking from the top of the skull. Somebody's cut off the top of the skull, removed it so that we can look right inside the cranial vault. This is what we call the anterior cranial fossa. Here is the middle cranial fossa, and then down over here is the posterior cranial fossa. So be sure to look at these things. All right, so I don't know if this is an exam figure or not, but this is the view that will be really helpful for you in most labs, but be sure to understand from your lab instructor what they're expecting. In my classes, I'm expecting that you know all of these foramina right here, and that will eventually be a quiz for you in lab. All right, so right here, this is the ethmoid bone. Okay, don't forget the ethmoid bone has a perpendicular plate, helps make the nasal septum. It also has paranasal sinuses, so it air conditions the air and protects you from infection. And it has this horizontal plate right here, which we call the cribriform plate. And what does this cribriform plate have in it? It has a bunch of holes, which we call foramina. And so the ethmoid bone has what we call all these olfactory foramina to allow olfactory nerves to enter your nasal cavity. So what is the sense of olfaction? Can you piece together? Can you extrapolate a little bit? I didn't define for you what the sense of olfaction is, but what the heck is that sense? Yeah, smell. That's exactly right. So the ethmoid bone is also very important because you use it for smelling because of all of those olfactory foramina right there. So if I was going to pick one bone as being kind of like my favorite, I guess I would have to say ethmoid bone, because it's important for breathing, important for smelling. It protects you from infection, holds your brain in place, because there's one other structure there which we can barely see right here. See this line? But if we were to take that line and rotate it around and look at it on edge, on its side, it kind of looks like a shark's fin sticking up. That's what we call the crista galli. And the crista galli is a bone that's sticking up in your brain, and there's a membrane that holds your brain in place, right? But that membrane would slosh around inside your head, except that it's attached to the crista galli. So the ethmoid bone not only does all those other things, but it helps hold your brain in place so that when you move your head, your brain doesn't go sloshing around up there. So that's a pretty good thing. I like that ethmoid bone a lot. Okay, frontal bones, once again, here's that sphenoid bone. Here's that depression called the sella turcica in the sphenoid bone for holding the pituitary gland. You don't have to know all these other little structures of the sphenoid bone unless you're interested. Okay, here's the temporal bone. And this region, well, here is where we have the internal acoustic meatus. And corresponding over here is where the external acoustic meatus is. And in between, we call that the petrous part of the temporal bone. And that's the part of the temporal bone that contains organs for maintaining your balance, which we call equilibrium, as well as hearing. All right, so this is kind of a massive, big part of the temporal bone right here. All right, so I do want you to go over these and make sure you know these foramina, no matter whose lab you're in. Okay, so I would guess you should probably draw these out. So maybe let's go over these really quick. So what side of the skull is this right here? Yeah, I would say anterior. I don't know if it is in your book or not. And then down over here would be posterior. Let me see if I can just change the scale a little bit. Good enough. All right, so make sure you know these are the olfactory foramina. And then here is a hole right here called the optic canal. What's that good for? Vision, right? So the optic nerve goes through the sphenoid bone right there. And then we have a round hole right here we call foramen rotundum. And then here is an oval one. See how easy this is? Foramen ovale. And then there's a really small one right here we call spinosum. And there's going to be a ridge. And so you go over that ridge down into this little valley. And what do we find in the floor of a lot of valleys sometimes? Yeah, like a lake, right? So here we have a little foramen lacerum right here. Okay. And then we got that internal acoustic meatus that's going to match up with the external acoustic meatus, and a really big hole right here, jugular foramen. What's that a passageway for? For the jugular vein. Jugular vein, yeah. Yeah, let's look. Here we have the internal acoustic meatus, and then right over here is going to be the external acoustic meatus. So right, if you're going to line those two holes up, the petrous region is going to be right here. And it's going to be really big and thick. It's going to have kind of a ridge like that on there. That's what we call the petrous region. And if we were to break it open, we would notice a lot of cavities inside there. And I think we have maybe one bone in lab that's been cut open, and you can actually look in there. So the apparatus for hearing is stuck inside that part of the temporal bone. So we call that petrous region. It's like a holy part filled with different holes and things like that. All right, so jugular foramen. And then here is the foramen grande, which is called foramen magnum. All right, guess what? What's that a passageway for? Yeah, the spinal cord. As a matter of fact, that's kind of that's the line of demarcation between your brain and your spinal cord right here, that the foramen magnum. And then a little minor hole right here called the hypoglossal canal. Okay, so all of these things on the left-hand side I'm not so interested in, right? But for sure all of these foramina I am. Okay, I don't know if this is an exam figure or not, but it's really handy because on a practicum you might have to label like this foramen right here. And just by looking at that foramen, you might not know that it's the foramen ovale. Start with something you know, like what? What's the most posterior hole? Foramen magnum, or the most anterior? Olfactory, right? So and how to remember that. What's the most anterior feature on your face? Is your nose. Okay, sensory feature would be your nose. What's the next most anterior? Would be your eyes. Okay, so here we got optic canal. So be able to do this pretty quickly. Here we got what? Nice cranium right here. And what are all these things? Yeah? Olfactory foramina, and I'm going to abbreviate. Of course, I don't know if you can in lab talk to your instructor. Oh, what's this shark's fin sticking out? Yeah, the cribriform plate. All right, that's not a hole, of course, but since we were there, I thought I'd mention that. All right, so we got the olfactory foramina. What's the next foramen? Optic canal, that's in the sphenoid bone, right? So, optic canal, and then, yeah, foramen rotundum, and then, I did a pretty good job, foramen ovale, then a little one right here, spinosum. All right. Ah, don't forget, there's like a little ridge right here that you get down into this region. Yeah, foramen lacerum. Make sure you look at your spelling. Okay, then here's going to be your ear right here. External acoustic meatus. So right in this region here is going to be the internal acoustic meatus. All right, so there. Oh, then you got a pretty big hole right here. Jugular, foramen, right, foramen magnum, and then on the edge right over here is going to be the hypoglossal canal. Okay, so if you know how to do that, you'll be doing really good for the practicum, yeah.
Where's the stylomastoid foramen?
Stylomastoid foramen, okay. Let's look at, instead of looking into the cranial vault, let's look up from the base of the brain. Okay. I know some lab instructors really like that little guy right there because it kind of goes over nomenclature. All right, so stylomastoid. Where should we be looking? Well, here's the mastoid process. Here's the styloid process. Okay, and then there's going to be a really small little foramen right between the styloid process. Should I really enlarge this right here? Oh, maybe you can see it a little bit better. Okay, here's the styloid process, here's the mastoid process, and here's that little stylomastoid foramen right there, which I don't really see on, it's not very prominent on the inside of the skull. Okay. So, I don't necessarily like this illustration for this particular class. All right. I like looking from inside the cranial vault. Okay. And then here you can see the three cranial fossa, anterior cranial fossa, middle cranial fossa, posterior cranial fossa for holding different lobes of the brain. All right, now I don't think you're going to get a really good idea of the skull unless you can appreciate what the disarticulated bones look like. So it's important for you to know that this is the temporal bone right here. So here would be what? The zygomatic process. Here's the mastoid process. Here's the styloid process. Right, the squamous region, and the external acoustic meatus. And that's actually pretty easy to observe. And then here is that sphenoid bone that I said kind of looks like a bird or a bat or a butterfly. Here's that cella turcica for holding the pituitary gland. Optic canal is real important. Foramen ovale, foramen rotundum. This is the greater wing, and then here is the lesser wing of the sphenoid bone. Okay, so here's just another view of the sphenoid bone. Greater wing, lesser wing. A fissure is a long foramen in a bone. All right, so there are more nerves that go to the eye through this fissure right here, as well as blood vessels. Okay, because not only do you use the eye to see with, what do you do with your eye? You can look up, you can look down, right or left. So you have a lot of muscles around your eye that position your eye. They need nerves as well. They don't get innervation from the optic nerve. They get innervation from other kinds of nerves that we'll talk about. All right, and then posterior from the sphenoid bone, we have these big processes right here. All right, so about where is that sphenoid bone? If you go right through here, you go up into the pituitary gland. So what's down in this area right here? Nasal and oral cavity. Nasal and oral cavity. And here we have some processes. What's the function of a process most of the time, you're going to say? Muscle attachment, right? And so this is associated with what cavity?
Nasal
and Oral cavity. So guess what kind of muscles attach right here? Muscles for?
Eating.
Yeah, we call those muscles of mastication. All right, so those are going to be important muscles for elevating the mandible as well as grinding back and forth. And guess what the name of those muscles are? The pterygoid muscles. That's right. So don't forget that P is not pronounced. It's silent. Start pronouncing it with a T, right? The pterygoid muscles right there. All right, here's my favorite bone, namely the ethmoid, because if you rotate it, it kind of looks like the letter E. You might be wondering, right? So here is the vertical part. Here's one, here's second, here's the third bar that make up the E. Right, here's that crista galli. Here is the perpendicular plate that makes the superior part of the nasal septum. All of these are the ethmoid paranasal sinuses for fighting infection. Sometimes they get chronically infected, and then this ethmoid bone requires surgery to clear that infection out, for instance. Okay, great ethmoid bone. Mandible, body of the mandible, mental foramen, here's the angle. Here's the ramus, mandibular ramus, coming off at about a 90-degree angle to the body. All right, here is the coronoid process. What's the function of this process? Yeah, muscle attachment for chewing, again, for attaching muscles of mastication. Mandibular condyle. A condyle is a smooth surface on a bone. Guess what this mandibular condyle does? It's important for the temporomandibular joint. Maybe not so much for moving your whole head, but for moving your mandible for chewing. Okay, so those are some important parts of the mandible, including this mandibular foramen right there. Zygomatic process. Oh, don't forget the mandible has those alveoli for holding a tooth, right, as well as the maxilla. Here is the margin of the alveolus. And there's also a little process between the teeth right here. Sometimes we call that the alveolar process. And the thing that holds a tooth in the alveolus is called a ligament, a periodontal ligament. Dental. Anytime you hear dental or dentist, what should you think of? Tooth, teeth. Right, so periodontal means a ligament surrounding the root of this tooth, attaching it to the mandible. So here we got that nice frontal process again. And here's that orbital surface that forms the lower floor of the orbit. All right, these are nicely disarticulated for you in lab already. Talked about that picture pretty much already. Okay. All right, so here are the four paranasal sinuses. There's one in the frontal bone. And the way you see this one in lab is that you look at the mannequin. The mannequin has a frontal bone, and you can see that sinus very nicely. All right. The ethmoid bone has numerous sinuses. The sphenoid sinus is pretty big. And the biggest one is the maxillary sinus. What bone is that one in? Yeah, it's in the maxilla. You can tell from the name, but you could probably also tell from just the positioning. All right, so here's just a little quiz. Here we see the hard palate. What are the two bones that make up the hard palate? This illustration is okay. All right, but the anterior bone is the maxilla. What's the posterior bone? The palatine bone. All right, what does that palatine bone look like again?
L,
right? Okay. All right, so that's pretty good discussion of all these different bones. But here's that hyoid bone, which is inside the mandible. It's a horseshoe-shaped bone, just like the mandible is. A lot of important muscles for, and they're strong, for chewing, for articulation, for breathing. And that's what the job of this hyoid bone is right here. The hyoid is a pretty delicate bone. And you might be interested to kind of palpate it to see what it feels like, but I guess I would ask you not to do that, because that bone is so small and the muscles around it are so strong, if you push hard enough to feel it, guess what? You might actually break it. Okay, so I would just kind of leave it alone. But there's one on the skeleton up there, okay? Because we don't have any oral exams in here, but if you break that bone, you probably can't talk. Hopefully you can still breathe, okay? But it's a fairly delicate bone. All right, so that takes us to the vertebral column. The bones of the vertebral column we call vertebrae. Okay, and the vertebral column has a number of different divisions in it, and the vertebrae are specialized depending on what division they're in. Okay, the superior division is what we call cervical. It makes up your neck, right? So cervical vertebrae make up your neck. And some of the things that you have to know are how many vertebrae are in each particular division. And so here we see in cervical region we have 7. Okay, and they don't have special names. There's only 2 vertebrae that have special names. Usually we name them by number and the division that they're in. So the 7th cervical vertebrae, we just call that one C7, right? Because that's the most inferior one. C1 is the first one, C2 is the second one. So that nomenclature is used for subsequent divisions of the vertebral column as well. The next division is called thoracic. And these are the ones that have ribs associated with them, that have a joint with a rib. And so how many thoracic vertebrae are there? You see 12, right? And in order to be a thoracic vertebrae, it has to have an articulation with a rib. So how many pairs of ribs do most people have? They got 12. By definition, the number of thoracic vertebrae has to exactly equal the number of pairs of ribs that you have. Now we might find somebody in here that has 11 ribs, maybe 13. There's a little anatomic variation. All right, it doesn't really mean very much except that if you have 13 pairs of ribs, how many thoracic vertebrae are you going to have? 13, right? They got to be exactly the same. Okay, and then the next inferior division is what we call the lumbar division. Okay, and there are 5. So how are you going to remember that there's 7, 12, and 5 for these different divisions? Think of mealtime. When do you have breakfast? Yeah, just pretend you have breakfast at 7. And when do you have lunch? At noon. And when do you have dinner? On like a weekend. Maybe 5, right? Okay. So 7, 12, and 5 are the numbers of vertebrae that you have in cervical, thoracic, and lumbar division. All right, look at this hole right here. All right, so let's look at number 10 and 11 thoracic vertebrae. All right, we're gonna name all these different parts of these vertebrae right here. But here is a hole that forms between the vertebrae. What do we call a hole again?
Foramen.
A foramen. And what do you think? Why do you think that hole is there? For nerves to leave the spinal cord to go to your body, to innervate your body, or sensory nerves that are getting information from your body to bring it into the central nervous system. So this is what we call the intervertebral foramen. Very important to let nerves in and out of the central nervous system. All right, what else do I see right here? Well, I see between these vertebrae right here a joint, right, and that has an intervertebral disc in it. That disc is made up of fibrocartilage on the outside, which is what the strongest kind of cartilage that you learned about, of the 3 kinds that you learned about. And then there's like a gelatinous mass on the very inside of it. So when somebody damages their back and damages that fibrocartilage, that gelatinous material can actually poke out into the intervertebral foramen, right, and block those nerves so that you lose sensation in some part of your body, or it actually causes pain in that part of your body, some kind of referred pain. Sometimes we call that spinal stenosis when that happens. And that's kind of terrible when that happens, because you could be living in really difficult pain, intractable pain when that happens. Okay. Oh, here it says intervertebral foramen. Yeah, don't forget about these foramina, because when you look at just an individual vertebrae, you don't see the whole. It's only that when you put 2 of them together that you see that intervertebral foramen. Okay. 2 other divisions. All right, the sacral division down here has 5 vertebrae, but notice these are all special. Why is this a special area? Why is it different than the rest? These are all fused together, and usually there's about 5. There's some variation in this region right here. And then the last division are what we call the coccygeal. And this is the most highly variable region. It could have anywhere from 3 to 5 vertebrae that are all fused together in this region right here. Okay, we see some curvatures in the spinal cord. Okay, so here we have a posterior curvature, which we call the thoracic curvature. Why do you think your spinal cord curves posteriorly here in this direction, in that region right there? Okay, it's important for posture, but you have some important organs, like your heart and your lungs, right? And so those important organs push that part of the spinal cord posteriorly, so it makes room for important organs, right? And the same thing for the pelvic curvature right here. That's also important for allowing for pelvic organs to exist in this region. Now, if everything was pushed posterior in your body, what would happen to you when you stood up? Well, you'd fall backwards, right? So there are a couple other curvatures that help maintain weight more over the center of your body, like the cervical curvature is an anterior curvature, and the lumbar curvature is anterior, and so that helps redistribute weight in your body so that you can stand up. All right, so those are some important curvatures. Here you can see that nice intervertebral foramen once again. Oh, and here you can see what happens when the annulus fibrosis ruptures and allows the nucleus pulposus, the gelatinous material, to poke out into that intervertebral foramen and impinge on the nerve that's leaving the spinal cord right here. All right, so that causes a lot of difficulty in people. All right, so I'm sure this is an exam figure. This just shows you a typical vertebrae. All right, so you got to make sure you understand the basic properties of all vertebrae. All right, this part right here, which articulates with the vertebrae above and below it, it also supports the weight of the vertebral column. This is the vertebral body. This is the biggest and strongest part of a vertebrae. And then there's a bony plate that courses posteriorly, and it's going to help form the vertebral foramen right here. So this is what we call the pedicle. All right, we see a bony prominence sticking out laterally. Guess what we call, what's the function of these bony prominences that are sticking out laterally? Muscle attachment, right? So those are the transverse processes. We've got hundreds of muscles in the back. Fortunately, in this class, you don't have to know all the hundreds of muscles, but a couple of them, okay, that attach right here. So pedicle is that bony protection between the body and the transverse process, right? So here is a pedicle. And sticking straight posterior, if you run your fingertips over your back, you feel these little bumps back there, and that's produced by the spinous process of these vertebrae. Guess what the function of that spinous process is? Muscle attachment, again. And that bony plate between the spinous process and transverse process, we call that the lamina. All right, so make sure you know all of those things really, really, really well. Because does anybody in here know anybody with back problems? I bet everybody could raise their hand, right? And to understand back problems, these are just some of the fundamental structures of a vertebrae that you have to become familiar with. Okay. All right, and if we put the pedicles together with lamina, that forms this nice arch right here, which together with the vertebral body protects the spinal cord as it goes through the vertebral foramen. All right, so here are some smooth parts on these bones. What's a smooth place on a bone for? It's for an articulation, right? Okay, so this process, we call this a superior articulating process and facet, is going to articulate with a similar process and facet from the vertebrae that's above it. So make sure in lab you put a couple vertebrae together and see how they fit together nice right there. All right, then there are some vertebrae that have ribs attached to them. What kinds of vertebrae have ribs attached to them? Yeah, the thoracic. So here is an articulating facet here for the head of a rib, and then the rib goes posteriorly and articulates with the transverse process right here, and then it starts to course anteriorly to articulate with the sternum, that's anterior. So these two facets right here are for articulations with ribs, And those we only find on thoracic vertebrae. We don't see those on cervical vertebrae or lumbar vertebrae at all. Okay. Well, let's talk about a couple specific division, not just a general division, but specific divisions right now. This one is kind of interesting because I no longer see a vertebral body. It's gone on this particular vertebrae. And this is characteristic of C1. And C1 articulates with the occipital bone. Okay, and so it's got another name. It's named after that mythological figure that's holding up the world. Who's that? That's Atlas, right? So we call this the Atlas. It's also cervical vertebrae that I can see very nicely because in the transverse processes, I see a hole here and here. And so we call those the transverse foramina. That's a characteristic of cervical vertebrae. Only cervical vertebrae have these transverse foramina. So I could hold a vertebrae up and probably everybody in the class could tell me what division it's from just by looking at those foramina. So you might ask, where did that vertebral body go? And I'll show you where it went. Right? It went right here. So here is the vertebral body from C1, but it's attached to which vertebrae? C2. Okay, and so we call this thing, it goes by a couple of different names, maybe the dens or the odontoid process, and it allows for special articulation between C1 and C2, so it allows for a rotation between C1 and C2 around this axis right here, and so that's why we call C2 an axis. Okay, it also has these transverse foramina, which means what kind of vertebrae is it? It's a cervical vertebrae. Another characteristic of cervical vertebrae is that the spinous process usually is bifid, which means that it has two points instead of just one single point to it. So that's another easy way to tell cervical from any other kind of vertebrae. All right, so we got really good examples of this in lab. You would call this C2 or the axis. All right, some ranges of motion are pretty important. Between occipital bone and C1, I went backwards, right? Between C1 and the occipital bone, because of the nature of these joints right here, you cannot rotate your head, all right? You can with other parts of your neck, but not between C1 and the occipital bone. That kind of motion is only for flexion and extension, all right? And if you rotate at that joint, then something's going to break, namely C1 is going to break. All right, and that's, you never want to break a vertebrae, especially a cervical vertebrae. But a lot of times it's a nice stable fracture, which is a good thing. And it heals completely as long as what happens. What's really important with somebody with a cervical spine injury. Maybe you run into them. Maybe you're CPR certified. Okay? Make sure that you don't move their heads, right? And you tell them, don't move because you can take a stable fracture of this bone right here and make a compound fracture, and then it can go right into the spinal cord, and then they'll be up paraplegic for the rest of their life because we don't know how to help them over that kind of injury, right? All right, now C2, on the other hand, allows for rotation, all right, which is what? Your least favorite answer. No, right? That's a rotation, all right? But if you flex and extend between C1 and C2 like that, then this C2 is going to break, and usually the dens breaks off and it goes right into the spinal cord, and unfortunately that injury is usually immediately fatal. All right, so that's a terrible kind of thing. So you should appreciate these joints and know ranges of motion, know what is allowed at different kinds of articulations, because that's very, very important. All right, and then lastly you can see how C1 is stabilized against C2 by this nice transverse ligament right here, right? And again, the joint between C1 and C2 is what? A rotation. It's not flexion and extension. All right, the sign-in sheet is going around. Where's the sign-in sheet at? Probably way in the back. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And I guess that's going to be it for today.